Hail, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, and our views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line the Monica Jensen Stevenson, who's written a couple of my favorite books, Kiss the Boys Goodbye and Sprite House. And we're going to be talking today about an essay she wrote in a book we carry. It's called Into the Buzzsaw. That's Into the Buzzsaw, and it's the story of what happens, at least most of the essays, to the reporters who've tried to get the truth out about what's really going on in the world today. And I think most people who work in the media, whether they're in television or radio or whether they work for magazines or newspapers, honestly believe that, of course, you can get the truth out through regular channels. And then, of course, as long as you're not doing anything really very important, that is the case. But sometimes when you try to get an important story out and the government has an agenda or an individual of great wealth has an agenda, you suddenly find that you're not going to be able to get the truth out. In fact, rather than expose the truth, there are people who will destroy your career. And certainly Monica's essay in Into the Buzzsaw really doesn't deal so much with her. It deals with what happened to a young man who was taken prisoner by the communist in Vietnam and was a prisoner of war for 14 years and was smart enough to be able to trick the Vietnamese into letting him get into a hotel in Hanoi where he could pass a message to a foreign journalist. And eventually, of course, why the Vietnamese were forced to repatriate him. And then, of course, what the government did to discredit him, because they couldn't let the American people realize that it abandoned thousands of American boys from towns like yours and mine to live out their days as slaves or dying in Vietnam. Monica, that is really a very touching story, the story of Bobby Garwood.
Yes, it is. And, of course, the point that I make in Buzzsaw is that the press played a big part in the horrible things that happened to him when he came home, either because they just, you know, closed their eyes to the reality, or maybe even worse, maybe they knew, you know, deep down what had happened to him, but didn't want to risk any part of their career in order to do it. Certainly they didn't do their job, because if they had looked at this man who was, you know, met when he arrived in Bangkok from Vietnam with a reading of his rights and big proclamations that he was a traitor and that he had gone over to the other side voluntarily, if any reporter had done his homework at that time and looked at the time when Bobby Garwood was taken prisoner, they would have discovered that he was 10 days away from going home. Now, nobody, I mean, you would really have to be a moron to go over to the enemy just days before you could do it freely, you know, to defect, when you could do it freely as so many did, you know, the Jane Fonda's, et cetera, who visited North Vietnam freely. I mean, he could have gone on his own. He didn't have to defect 10 days before and risk, you know, a firing squad for doing that. But nobody, no reporter did the research on that. No one looked into his background. They just became part of the pack. I mean, he was vilified. His family was vilified. Rocks were thrown through their windows. It was just absolutely horrible when he came back, because the press simply took the story that the government handed out and propagated it and continued propagating it. And for the most part, they still do that today.
Well, of course, the disconcerting thing is to realize that the government prosecutors certainly had the evidence that Bobby Garwood wasn't a deserter, and he hadn't done anything different than any of the other people who'd been tortured over there, and probably done a lot less to cooperate with the communists, and he'd been smart enough to come home. And this was to be his punishment, and those prosecutors had to know what they were doing was wrong and unjust. And you pointed out in your article how many people who got up on the stand, military people, lied, and pressure was put on them by the government to get them to lie. Isn't that illegal?
Well, a subordination of perjury certainly is.
But of course, when the government
there's been talk of bringing down a president because of subordination of perjury, and we didn't do it, but certainly everybody knows. And that clearly went on, and that I prove that in my book, Spite House, and I talk a little bit about that in Buzzsaw, and how, again, the press ignored the responsibility of looking behind the scenes, of investigating. So many reporters pride themselves on being investigative reporters, but there was no investigation.
You point out that the government spent millions of dollars to try to convict this man, who really should have been a hero, who was smart enough to have gotten out, and instead they had to demonize him, because if he wasn't demonized and destroyed, then people might listen to him and realize that we had abandoned all those people, and that people like Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon had lied. And lied and lied repeatedly. Maybe Richard Nixon would not be now the man who has been called, because of the great respect everybody has for him, to head the presidential or the congressional committee to find out what really happened on September 11th. If people had known he had lied at that time, maybe he wouldn't be there today, carrying out this.
Maybe he would, because I honestly think that we've lost control over things like that. I don't think decisions like that are made at all with the input of the American people. I mean, in my experience, the people across the country, when I've been on radio programs like yours, been interviewed by small newspapers, people are pretty smart. They really know what's going on. But when they try to transmit that information to Washington, it gets lost along the way, or really it just gets ignored. I mean, they know in Washington what people want.
And
they don't care. I think the Senate Select Committee on POWs was really formed as a result of people lobbying for that. They really wanted it, and I've been told that that was in large part due to the book Kiss the Boys Goodbye. Because everywhere I spoke, I would say, call your congressman, call your senator, if you've just really got to push this. Well, so they did, but, no one had any idea, and even I didn't have any idea, that even a Senate Select Committee could be manipulated.
All right, we're going to have to interrupt you there. We're just going to tell our listeners about a couple of the items that we carry, and certainly we're suggesting that people consider the possibility that maybe once the government is telling the truth, and when they tell us there are going to be terrorist attacks in America, and maybe they should begin making some preparations. Now, I don't necessarily believe there are going to be terrorist attacks, but I think there are going to be some severe disruption of our society. And besides that, the worst thing you can do is make preparations and nothing happens. But think what will happen if something major, cataclysmic, does occur and you haven't made preparations. So if you'd like to get more information, a checklist and a catalog of various things that you may want to get in preparation for the difficult times which I believe lie ahead, call Ready Reserve Foods at 1-800-453-2202. That's 1-800-453-2202. And another thing you can do, of course, is consider getting the active ingredient in garlic, which is called Alamax. Actually, the active ingredient is called Allicin, and this Alamax is a proprietary product that gives you pure research-grade Allicin, and you can actually get that by calling 1-866-405-4000. It seems, at least according to British studies, to help your immunity. Give them a call at 1-866-405-4000 and just ask them to get you some material on Alamax. I think you'll be very pleased if you try it. And then, of course, let me suggest that if we carry the Miracle 2 soap products, and we can't make any medicinal claims for them, all we can do is tell you that a lot of our listeners, I think that they've really helped them. If you'd like the Miracle 2 soap products, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, and we can guarantee you it's the best soap that you've ever used, but call right now. four tapes yet, genocide. And one of the tapes is an interview with a Dr. Dinigan who heard back in 1969 actually a talk given by Dr. Day, who would later become the president of Planned Parenthood. And Dr. Day laid out the whole plan for America. The fact there are too many people, the fact that we're going to have to create new diseases, the fact that we're going to have to conceal some of the very obvious treatments for cancer because people are going to have to die of something. They might as well die of cancer. An incredible interview and a series of other interviews that will go into the background of what is happening in America, why new diseases are cropping up all the time. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR for copies of our four-tape set, Genocide. It's vitally important that you help us to get this message out across America, because without knowledge, my people perish. America, our values, our future are under attack today. And, of course, Dr. Day was the medical director of Planned Parenthood for a number of years. Our guest today is Monica Jensen Stevenson. We're talking about the book Into the Buzzsaw. And, incidentally, are either one of your books, either Kiss the Boys Goodbye or Spite House, available today?
No, those books aren't. But we're waiting for the film to be made, and I'm sure that Spite House will be reissued when the film is made.
All right. Of course, do you want to mention what happened to the 5,000 copies they printed up there in Canada?
Well, you know, I'm reluctant to really make too much of that. It's
right.
That was the publisher who really saved Kiss the Boys Goodbye in the first round, and so I have an editor there who is so loyal to this issue and so committed, and she pushed and pushed for the book to be republished, and she managed to get them to do it. And we had really, I don't know, thousands of orders from all over the states because there's a new law, so it was really a lot easier for them to sell books published in Canada in the states.
Now, that was Kiss the Boys Goodbye.
That was Kiss the Boys Goodbye, and it had an afterword, a new one, which dealt with, you know, some of the select committee material. And it was at a time when that press was actually going under, was having great financial difficulties, and was being taken over by a university here, and Random House from the States took over part of it. And the books were destroyed.
The
brand newly published books were destroyed. And the man who's responsible swears up and down, and you know, I really believe him. I can't believe he would do it other than by mistake. He's just a young man. He hasn't had that much experience.
All right,
but of course, the thing that bothers me is that they haven't republished them. So, you know, it's, but I'm going to get the rights back, and that book will see the light of day again. I promise.
Well, this is the book, Kiss the Boys Goodbye. If you haven't read it, if you can get a copy anyplace, it's really well worthwhile reading. It's really the book that really brought the attention of the American people on the fact we betrayed those boys and we left them there.
But I'll tell you what's interesting about that book is in the process of reprinting it, my good friend, the editor, Pat Kennedy, did a little bit of research, because we had always wondered why so many people knew about that book, why it was in every library in the States, and people were still clamoring to buy it, but we were never paid a cent. And we had our accountant look into it, and again, you know, there was no evidence. It was like the money trail was just non-existent. And when Pat was investigating this in the second round, she found that book never appeared on the formal New York Times bestseller list, but apparently the New York Times has another list that isn't published, but, you know, the second 10 bestsellers. And for 2 or 3 years, it was on that list.
Would you like to tell our listeners, just a little off the subject, but how it was that your husband co-wrote the book with you? Because you were talking about the CIA and drugs, and he was he thought you were a little loony, didn't
well,
he?
Well, he did. You know, he has a distinguished military background himself. He's the author of A Man Called Intrepid and other books on intelligence. He wrote 90 Minutes at Entebbe. All of those were really, really big bestsellers, and the two books simultaneously, Entebbe and A Man Called Intrepid, and I think for the long, long time, Intrepid was the longest nonfiction bestseller on that list. And he had very good relationships, as I did too. You know, when you work for a show like 60 Minutes, as I did, you have good relationships with very solid professionals. You know, there by no means everybody in those agencies is a bad person. They are very good people. But as I got more and more involved in that story, it became very difficult for Bill because he just had a very hard time believing that these things actually happened. And if it hadn't been for some of the men we were working with, like Red McDaniel, who had been a prisoner for 7 years and whose record was just so impeccable, a fellow pilot, I don't know, I might have lost Bill. But, you know, he couldn't help but be persuaded by the overwhelming evidence and the caliber of the people. You know, these are people who have been made to look like they're crazy. Who can't get over the fact that, I mean, they've been portrayed like guys who fell apart, you know, because of the war, and instead they were the bravest, they held out, they are remarkable in the sense that they don't even hate their enemies. I mean, Red McDaniel has forgiven everybody. He's just almost a perfect human being in that sense. Anyway, those are the people who persuaded Bill that we were really onto a story. And it became increasingly difficult, though. You know, there was a lot of things happened that were disappointing because, you know, you find your whole sort of belief system falling apart.
And, of course, one of the things you mentioned in the book is the fact that there's this CIA involvement in drugs behind so much of this.
Yeah. That, you know, that was certainly true, and that whole Southeast Asian operation. And now, you know, people talk about it as a matter of course. Now it's all out in the open, and the amazing thing is that people aren't shocked. Now it's sort of like, oh, well, of course, you know, it happened then. But what's happening now is that the biggest drug supply comes from Afghanistan. And, you know, I am not working on that subject, but every once in a while, I kind of put two and two together,
and I see
so many similarities, and I see, what's really frightening is that I see some of the same people involved. And I just wonder how much of what we're hearing is truth and how much isn't. You know, I found out through, I know you had Mark Smith on your show the other night, and I found out through one of his colleagues, actually, and I've since also checked that with other sources, that Mohammed Atta, who smashed the plane into the World Trade Tower, had a long history of being a terrorist and was actually in prison in Israel. And it was about 3 years ago that the Clinton administration put pressure on Israel to release these guys. And Israel didn't want blood on their hands, so they did not really want to do this unless Clinton absolutely made them. And he did. He put enormous pressure on, and they did. And we knew Atta's history, and yet he was somehow able to get into the United States, take flying lessons. And, you know, I know that we have all the resources to track these people and that he was tracked. Now, what is going on here?
Well, that's a different subject, but I... you're absolutely right, because...
To me, it all started...
Another cover-up.
Yeah, it all started, during the Vietnam War. I mean, one of the information that Bobby Garwood brought out with him, and that was taken very seriously, for example, by the former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, General Eugene Tai, who always supported Bobby Garwood, was that the Palestinians, who were acknowledged as terrorists in those days, now we seem to think that, you know, they're a bona fide government, or should be anyway, but they were using prisoners, American prisoners, as guinea pigs in Vietnam.
Now, this was the PLO.
This is the PLO.
This was Arafat's PIO.
This is Arafat's PLO.
The man we're financing right now.
That's right. And Bobby Garwood was an eyewitness, was part of that. As a matter of fact, he was threatened by the PLO before he left.
Now, wasn't it threatened if you ever tell anybody that we were torturing American prisoners, our good friends, the PLO, who we financed through these years?
That's right. And no one in the government certainly wanted to hear that. No one took it seriously. And no one even took it on the sly, took it and did something with it to protect the country. So, you know, again, Bobby Garwood's story is connected to so many of these things. And when I look at the world today and what's happened since September 11th, I can just see direct lines going back to that. And, you know, there are people very high in this current administration. There were people very high in the last administration. They seem to be in every administration. It doesn't really make any difference whether it's Republican or Democrat. These people seem to maintain their power, and we know what they were doing during the war.
Yeah, and of course,
this is where it started.
And we see Dick Cheney, former Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, former Secretary of Defense, and, you know, 25 years ago, Admiral Poindexter coming back, and Henry Kissinger coming back. They don't have very many people, but they sort of move them around like musical chairs.
Yeah. And all of these people have amassed tremendous wealth. And, you know, we see some people now, and as a sideline, they have a big government position here, and as a sideline, they have positions like being part of the Chamber of Commerce in Uzbekistan, or another obscure part of the world that borders Afghanistan. And we've got this huge oil pipeline going through Afghanistan, and we've got it as the biggest drug producer now.
Okay, we're going to have to just interrupt you there. We've got to take another quick break, but we'll get right back to these things with Monica Jensen Stevenson in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I just certainly want to mention to you that if you have children or grandchildren, we hope that many of you will seriously consider getting a Philopoly set for them so they can learn to read and spell and pronounce words phonetically. And basically, it's a board game played like Monopoly. It's fun to play. I've actually played it. And, of course, it's based upon phonics. And phonics is how you should learn to read, certainly not the way that they're teaching our children now. Back in 1800, we had a 95% literacy rate. Today, we have almost 100 million people partially or completely functional illiterate. You couldn't do that bad a job unintentionally. Monopoly, most of the programs will cost you $300 or $400 to teach a child to read phonetically. This is $139.95, and we throw in two books. So give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We carry the Robinson Homeschool Curriculum. Take your child from grammar school to high school graduation for $199.95. If you'd like more information on it, give us a call. Again, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then, of course, if you'd like to understand what really happened on the 11th of September, you'll want to get my video. It's called 911 Contrived. That's 911 Contrived, and you can get that. You can get my video, The Brotherhood of Darkness, or get the Brotherhood of Darkness special, which is a book, the video, the audio tape for $29.95. But call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR right now. A book that will really help you to understand the nature of the spiritual battle in which we're currently involved is Gary Kaw's book, The Demonic Roots of Globalism. Now, you may remember Gary Kaw's book, En Route to Global Occupation. His second book, The Demonic Roots of Globalism, goes into the very real spiritual forces, the dark and sinister spiritual forces, which have energized those people who are molding the world in which we live today. Going to the background of Masonry, Theosophy,
and he actually quotes extensively from the writings of these people who have helped to mold the events of the 20th century. The Demonic Roots of Globalism by Gary Carr will give you tremendous insight into the background of what's happening in America today, and unless you understand the spiritual forces at work, you really can't understand the unfolding of events. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and ask for The Demonic Roots of Globalism by Gary Carr.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this afternoon, Monica Jensen-Stevenson. I wish her two books were available. We've actually carried both of them. One is called Spite House, the other is called Kiss the Boys Goodbye, but hopefully one of these days they will be back in print. But right now we're talking about a book where she has written an essay. It's called Into the Buzzsaw, and she tells the story of Bobby Carwood and this truly heroic individual who managed to escape from the Vietnamese by using his own wits. And, of course, when he's brought back, why the government sets out to destroy him. And if they would destroy him, would they destroy you? Would they destroy anybody? And when you have a government that gets people to purge of themselves, and of course, there were incidents of that. What was the story of this man who had actually been part of the Vietnamese hierarchy, who defected to the West, and he knew Bobby Garwood, and Bobby Garwood wanted, of course, to have him at the trial, and the man said he had never heard of him. What was that story all about?
Well, Bobby almost gave up during the court-martial. I mean, he had such tremendous power amassed against him, and he had just come, you know, out of prison. He was devastated by everything that had happened, and he's a very bright guy, so he soon realized that there really wasn't anything that he could do during the court-martial. So he sat quietly. He didn't even speak. He never took the stand, but then he read the newspapers avidly, and it was a time when a half Chinese, a Vietnamese defector had come out, and he immediately recognized him as a man who had been in charge of prisoners. And the reason that this man defected was because there was a conflict between the Chinese and the Vietnamese, and so the people of Vietnamese descent, Chinese descent in Vietnam, were in a lot of trouble. Now, this man was so knowledgeable about the entire Vietnamese infrastructure that one of our top intelligence people flew to Hong Kong to debrief him. And, of course, we didn't know this at the time, but certainly the government knew it. And they actually found out the truth about Bobby Garwood, along with the truth about a lot of prisoners, from this man. I know this from General Tai, who kept advising me when I first started working on the story of the prisoners, to go talk to this guy, to find this man, to talk to him, because he had all the information. Bobby saw the paper about this fellow, who was actually disguised with a motorcycle helmet, but he had a very, he had a unique figure, let's just put it that way, very large, obese, and that's how Bobby recognized him. And he said to his lawyers, you know, this man will prove I am who I am. I mean, ordinarily he wouldn't have trusted him, but he figured since this guy now defected, he would be on his side. So the prosecution didn't want this to happen. And but the Bobby's lawyers pushed, and a meeting was set up. And Bobby immediately identified him. There was first a lineup. And then they were together, and the man denied knowing Bobby. But he gave very subtle signals to Bobby, sort of letting him know that he couldn't do otherwise, that he was under a great deal of pressure. That meeting was actually held in the office of the people who were supporting this defector. He was generally known as the mortician. All the money that was supporting him and his family, he had brought his family out as well, was coming from that office and the officials who were, who were watching him. Well, after this happened, Bobby's entire defense team lost confidence in Bobby. They had gotten very excited about this, and they thought, well, you know, maybe this guy is telling the truth. And, from then on, it was just downhill. Well, it took about 15 years to find out the truth of what happened, and that was during the Senate Select hearings when Senator Smith, who had taken a great interest in Bobby, and as a matter of fact ended his opening speech by saying, "I'm here," he was the co-chair of the committee, "I'm here because I believe Bobby Garwood," tracked this man who was in the witness protection program, tracked the mortician down, and had his people debrief him under oath. And that is when, and this is part of the Senate records, so I'm not making anything up, and I have copies of those records, and anyone can go look at them. When this man was interviewed by the Senate investigators for the committee, he admitted that before his meeting with Garwood, people from the government, it was actually a man in uniform, came to see him and told him that he was going to see Bobby Garwood the next time, and when he would see him, to say that he did not know him. So, I mean, you know, that's the kind of thing that happened under Stalin's time in the Soviet Union.
And that's the sort of thing that happens in America today. And if
yeah.
you think that the same people will give us the truth about yeah. what happened last year, you've got to have your... Well, you probably think your yeah. Enron stock's going to come back again. But it really, it's so tragic. You tell about other military officers who obviously had pressure put on them so that they would lie under oath. And the whole thing was they spent millions of dollars to destroy this man, and his crime was he came home only one
night. Right. Well, Bobby could actually have been found guilty, and if he had been found guilty of defecting to the other side, of deserting, the sentence for that was the firing squad, and they brought his superiors to the trial, and they said that Bobby had definitely deserted because he was not assigned the job that Bobby said he was assigned on that day.
But they were lying.
And they were lying, and it was proven that they were lying. And here again, the press totally abrogated its responsibility because one of Bobby's buddies came forward on his own, came forward to the trial from Detroit to North Carolina and said, "I can testify that Bobby did have a job that day, that he didn't desert. He was sent on that mission, and I can prove it because I wanted that job, because I wanted to take over his job when he left. It was a kind of cushy job. He was a driver for the intelligence section, and I wanted that job, and they didn't give it to me, and I know that Bobby went on it." So that entire part of the prosecution's case had to be abandoned, and these two men were made, I mean, to be liars. I mean, it was clear as day. Now, did any reporter at that time research that, look at that story, see, talk to his buddy and find out what really happened on the day, look at the fact that Bobby could have faced the firing squad? Not a single reporter did his job properly. And, you know, I mean, you really, really have to ask yourself why. I mean, that was just, there was no, you know, and this was a few years after Watergate, right, when all reporters prided themselves on their investigative skills. I mean, that's what every reporter wanted to be. And here they had such a wonderful story right in front of them, and they were all there. And a lot of other things that went on, you know, the judge on the courts, like Pontius Pilate, saying he washed his hands of it all. People who wanted to testify, like the woman who interviewed every prisoner who came home, saying that, you know, she had interviewed all of them and they had never said anything about Bobby being the horrible man that, you know, some of his fellow prisoners now said, because they were probably under pressure as well.
Because a lot of them had collaborated, and this would have all been brought out, so it's either you lie for us, or we're going to tell everything bad you did.
Well, and you know, for a fact, and I have those documents, for a fact, they were allowed to substitute a statement. Some of them were allowed to substitute a statement for testimony sworn under oath. And, you know, I had a very hard time getting the original testimony that they had given under oath, but I have it.
Well,
but it's not part of the official record. Part of the official record just is a nondescript kind of statement about what happened.
Well, now, you mentioned something about pictures or movies or something that they had of Garwood, so that they knew he was never really a deserter. What was that about?
Well, before he was released, they actually brought in an American cameraman interviewer who had a long history of good relationships with regimes like the communist regime in Vietnam. Now, he told me that, you know, he had worked with the CIA and that he got that film for them. But, you know, I don't know whether that's true or not. Anyway, he was called in by the Vietnamese to prove that Garwood had gone over voluntarily. So what the film shows is this very, very skinny, emaciated man with very rotten teeth being led around by the Vietnamese to his, you know, by their standards, luxury apartment with luxury cooler and all the food that he wanted. And I mean, they did ridiculous things like take him to his regular barber who didn't know him, and it was clear on the film. And then we were introduced to his girlfriends who, you know, were very coy, and also it was clear that Bobby hadn't recognized them. And this is uncut film that I have a copy of. It's since been manipulated. Since I have shown that film, they've gotten a hold of it and they've made it look like something else. But I still have the entire uncut version. So, you know, there's no question of what is there. And what one sees in the uncut version are the Vietnamese security people getting really upset, sometimes even with the cameraman, because they're being too familiar, they're being too nice to Bobby. And at one point, the cameraman turns to them and says, you know, you guys have got to clear off, because this isn't going to work if you don't. So that's, and of course, the government knew of that film. I mean, the cameraman told me that, you know, it was originally confiscated, there's no way that they wouldn't have known about that. And they certainly knew about it once I got my hands on it, because, you know, I talked about it, and General Tai told me that if Bobby ever got another trial and that film were shown at the trial, he would be cleared within seconds.
Yeah, but of course the government didn't want him cleared.
They
had to discredit him because they couldn't let the American people know that Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon and everybody in the administration had lied, with a few exceptions. There were a few people who were honest. Certainly, I think James Schlesinger testified.
That's
before,
right.
He was a former Secretary of Defense, testified before these committees that he knew that they'd left the boys behind. And then Kissinger got up and said, oh, no, it's not true.
No, because you see, to them, their career were so important. And they viewed Bobby Garwood as a nothing. They viewed Bobby Garwood the way the French aristocrats before the revolution would view a peasant. I've always found it so ironic that they would destroy a whole life for their own careers. Because, I mean, after all, Kissinger has a Nobel Peace Prize. All these guys have done very well. So they can't possibly tell the truth, even if some of them feel a little bit guilty about it. They will never destroy their own careers. They can talk themselves out of that very easily.
Well, we're going to be back in just a moment with Monica Jensen Stevenson. Right now, of course, I want to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And as you know, we spend 5 hours every day behind a microphone. And, of course, we have a weekend program as well that's heard on about 36 stations. And we do have a small voice that reaches out across America. But it's a growing voice, and we're telling you what you're not going to hear on most radio programs. So if you agree that there is a problem and you'd like to work with us in our effort to reach more people, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And for a suggested gift of at least $20 a month, you'll get our 4 best tapes of the month. You'll get our monthly newsletter. But more than that, you'll be helping us as we reach out across America. If you'd like a free copy of my October newsletter, which is the testimony of Kristen Breitweiser before the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, telling what really happened on September 11th, I think you'll be amazed amazed because the video cameras were rolling and the reporters were there, and they just didn't cover what she said. But we've reproduced it in our October newsletter. Give us a call at 1-800-5-4489. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We'll send you a free copy of the newsletter. If you haven't gotten it before, of course, we really hope that you're going to want to subscribe to the newsletter, but we'll be glad to send it to you. Go to our website at radioliberty.com. You can get it there. We post all of our newsletters. And, of course, you can listen to our radio programs 5 hours a day at radioliberty.com.
Have you ever wondered what really happened in Oklahoma City? Well, a very important video is the cover-up in Oklahoma City. It really consists of film clips that were actually taken from video footage shot during the first 2 or 3 days after the bombing. And you'll actually hear the commentators in Oklahoma City talking about the second bomb, the third bomb that had been disarmed. Now, if they were actually disarming bombs there, why didn't we hear that throughout the rest of the country? You'll actually hear an interview with one of the gentlemen who was in the Murrah building at the time that the bomb went off, and he had time then to jump underneath his desk before the glass blew in from outside. Obviously, there were two bombs, one inside, one outside. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. It is vitally important that you help us to get this message out across America, because without knowledge, my people perish.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest, Monica Jensen-Stevenson. Caller asked if you know what's happened to Bobby Garwood.
I'm sorry.
Yes, I was saying a caller had called in and asked if you knew what Bobby was doing now.
Oh, yes. Yes, I do. I'm in touch with him on a fairly regular basis. He's always had certain skills at fixing things, mechanical, and that's what he continues to do. And it makes his living, and he has a very happy second marriage. His wife died a few years ago, and after Kathy, who was absolutely an amazing person, if you believed in Bobby, if you didn't believe in Bobby before you met her, you believed it after you met her. She was the sister of an MIA, and it was very hard for him to go through, but he's found someone else, and so his personal life is in very good shape, and that helps a lot. And he, of course, hopes for an appeal. I don't know whether he really believes that it will ever happen, because, you know, it will require so much money for lawyers to take it up. But all the evidence is there. All the evidence. I mean, with the report, the mortician story, you know, that came out through the Senate Select Committee, and other documentation, and his debriefings and the information that came out through the fellow who debriefed the mortician in Hong Kong about other prisoners. I forgot to mention, you probably know this because you know my book so well, but at one point they had called in the mortician, the Defense Intelligence Agency had called in the mortician to identify some prisoners. And one of the pictures they had was of Bobby Garwood, and the mortician said, "Well, that's Bobby Garwood. I know him." And he was a pilot prisoner. He thought Bobby had been a pilot. Bobby wasn't a pilot, but he said, "That's the pilot prisoner, Bobby Garwood." And that is actually what triggered Senator Smith's interest and determination to bring him before the Senate Select Committee. And get his answers under oath.
And of course, the government knows, but they will not exonerate him. What did he do? Spend 6 months in prison or something? What happened?
You mean after his court martial?
Right, after his court martial.
No, he didn't actually go to prison. And I think, when you look at it, just sort of without knowing the facts, the sentence, you know, appeared very mild. He just lost all compensation, no medical care, all rights of a citizen, stayed in the Marine Corps, wasn't able to get a job, no back pay, and his reputation, his honor, was totally destroyed. But, you know, he did manage to pull himself together. I mean, the amazing thing about Bobby is that he's always been able to do that. And it's one of the reasons that he was able to escape from the Vietnamese. And he's always done it in kind of the same way. He uses his intelligence and his cleverness in fixing things. And when he was a prisoner, of course, it was his language skill that also was so helpful. But you know, he built his life again, and a large part of that was that he found his first wife, who he was with for 14 years, and that's exactly the amount of time that that he was in prison. And he told me after she died, and he really put it very beautifully. He said, you know, God took 14 years of my life, but then he gave me the 14 years back when he brought Kathy into my life. So it was, in his eyes, it was an even kind of equation. And that's, you know, that those are the things that are important to him. He's very close to the few remaining members of his immediate family. His father's dead now, his brother's died, his sister's died, but he still has a younger half-sister who he's very close to. He visits with them every year, goes fishing with them. And, you know, that's, he's thankful for that, but it's still, you know, it's a horrible thing to have your honor destroyed. And one of the things that was so awful at the, and this is another example of how the press functions, when he was finished with the court-martial and the sentence was, I guess most of the people on the prosecution felt that it was too light, suddenly he was charged with child abuse. And that hit every tabloid in the country. I mean, it was, I don't know if you remember, but it was everywhere. Bobby Garwood, child molester. And he was so easily able to prove that because they had really made a big mistake in setting it up. He wasn't even in the town. He was, and he could prove it because he was known to be. He was with miles and miles away.
So they will stop at nothing to discredit him.
That's right. And you know that they never printed the fact that they couldn't even go anywhere with that case. That he was totally, but I mean totally irrevocably cleared, that there was not one shred of evidence and that he had in fact been set up. But you know, that kind of a rumor is so invidious, so destructive, that Kathy's parents always believed it, even when the relationship got a little bit better. And you know, because both Kathy and Bobby worked very hard to be close to them, I spoke to them, and they would always say, well, you know, that's a terrible thing in his background. How can we trust him near our grandchildren, et cetera, et cetera. And it you know, some people simply, if it's been in the papers, they believe it. The press has tremendous power. And when the government or anyone is really out to destroy a person, the best way to do it is to somehow co-opt or whatever way, get the press to do the job for them, because then it's done thoroughly. It's very difficult to come back after that.
Well, at first, that reminds me of the story of April Oliver, who'd put together a story for CNN, and they were going to destroy her. And you know, you hear all these stories about how she got sued and they got fired. And obviously, to discredit the story of Operation Tailwind, when she finally won the lawsuit and got a massive settlement, why, none of the newspapers would ever carry that. She had simply been discredited. We could never let the people know that what she said was the truth. And I think it's a pretty standard operating procedure, isn't it?
It seems to be. I mean, I was amazed at some of the other stories into the buzzsaw. It really, when you touch on certain stories, you walk right into the buzzsaw. There's no question about it. And you know, what was interesting is that there's a man who has written some wonderful books dealing with the prisoner issue as well. His name is Jim Sanders. He was a co-author on one of the books, and his name cropped up. I don't know if you noticed that on the investigation into the flight that was shot down off Long Island, the one that the editor, Christina Borgeson, did as well. Somebody who was involved in that investigation came to Jim Sanderson because they knew of his background, and brought him one of the seats from the airplane to investigate, because it was all classified, and they thought he could do a separate investigation, independent. And of course, Jim did, and he found that there was missile fuel, with all that implies, on that airplane seat. And you know, he's under indictment.
Oh, this was, of course, TW-800, and
right.
They couldn't let the American people know that that was shot down by a missile, so they had a conspiracy to cover it up. And we've actually interviewed both Jack Cashel and Jim Saunders on that. It's an amazing, amazing story. Incidentally, if you haven't seen the video that was put out on that, Jack Cashel and Jim Saunders put out, it's called Silence. We actually carry that, an excellent, excellent video. And the book we're talking about is called Into the Buzzsaw. We actually carry that. It's available through Radio Liberty, and you really want to get this. And there are 18 essays, one of them written by Monica Jensen Stevenson and April Oliver and Gary Webb and Kristen Borgensen. And fascinating, fascinating stories. If you honestly believe anything you read in the newspaper, you really need to read this book. And it's written by authors and producers and people who tried to tell the truth and found out about the buzzsaw. Well, we're just about out of time. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners today?
Well, I back what you just said, and I'd like to add to that is that, you know, we're all journalists who really, we're not inexperienced. We have all gotten awards, journalism awards. I have the Emmy. I have the Gold Medal at the New York Film Festival for Best Documentary. And there are people who wrote items for that book who have the Pulitzer Prize. So, you know, it's difficult to discredit us. And I think when, as a group, we stand and we each tell our own stories and they all have the same ring to them and they all deal with the same problems, there's no way that you can't accept it. I mean, you really have to close your eyes and, it's important for people to read that and to keep it in mind.
In other words, what you're basically saying is we do not have a free press. It's all right to write something, but when it comes up against the government, against the official government policy, you write it, they'll destroy it. Would that be a fair statement?
I think so. And the other, I start with the point that, you know, Eisenhower spoke about the military-industrial complex. Well, I think we have a military-industrial press complex. I think that is part of that complex. And they wield tremendous power. And, you know, people really have to start wresting it back. They have to take it back again, which I think there is still enough power in the people in the United States to do that. But it really takes constant vigilance. I mean, you can't just watch Larry King every night and be overwhelmed by the fact that these people are on his program and that, you know, you have to, you know, read history so that you know what's happened in the past and what can happen. And you really have to judge the past with what is going on today.
Amen. Well, thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure to have you.
It's been great.
Bye-bye.
Talking to
we'll
you.
Talk to you later. Our guest has been Monica Jensen Stevenson, always one of our favorite guests here. The book, Into the Buzzsaw, it's available by calling us at 1-800-544-8927, and please pray for America. Pray for revival, pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please remember to pray for our ministry, Radio Liberty, because we're on the front lines of this battle. Pray for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, goodbye. May the Lord be with you.
Program. Did you put us on or what? as soon as you got the 426, because I listened to, maybe I was listening during, anyway, I heard some Christmas music, and then just at the very end, of course, I heard my program. Anyway, well, we're on from 426 on. Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Do you want to get that message off the machine over there?
Okay, yeah,
well. And then that John Knight, Syracuse, said you had wanted him to call you about foreknowledge of World Trade Center bombing. He got that number.
All right, fine.